We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. When it's time for a new credit card, the best ones do way more than just buy stuff. And that's why U.S. Bank offers credit cards that make every day more rewarding. Earn cash back, score points when you shop, dine out, travel, or binge watch, or get a low intro APR. U.S. Bank credit cards were designed to fit your lifestyle. So make every day more rewarding and check out usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome in to the RotoWire NFL podcast. Today is Thursday, November 19th. I am your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. Mario, how are we doing?
Hey, John. I'm all right. How are you doing?
Doing well. I'm excited. We got another fun slate ahead of us. And, for once, and we'll get started here, we have a Thursday night game that might actually be good beyond the implications of just like entertainment value. You know, like the Broncos Jets game was technically a fun game to watch, but it wasn't particularly meaningful. Tonight we actually get treated to a Cardinals Seahawks game that, you know, is going to have major implications in the West and in the NFC and in fantasy. So I'm really excited to dive in on that one. We're going to get to the entire slate as we do every single episode here on the Thursday RotoWire NFL podcast. But Mario, let's get things rolling here with this pivotal matchup taking place in Seattle. The Seahawks 2.5-point favorites in this one. That's moved down from 3.5 where it opened earlier on in the week. So give us your initial read on how this one's going to shake out.
Well, the Seattle defense had Shaq Griffin out for, I think, the second half, or maybe a little bit more than that, of the first time they played. The Cardinals, of course, won. It was a strange outcome. There was a few things that, like that long Hopkins catch to Dunbar. That's a kind of play that's tough to pull off. So it was at once something that Kyler Murray and Hopkins did because they're awesome, but it's also a tough thing to make happen twice. And so if we were going into this game with more or less the same conditions as the last time, where Shaq Griffin had to leave and the Cardinals barely got a win out of it in overtime, and thanks largely to that Isaiah Simmons insane interception, that struck me as like a pretty, you know, by a hair sort of outcome the first time. And maybe I would guess, sure, in those conditions, maybe the Seahawks win 6 times out of 10, at least, even though they lost that one time. This time around, the Seattle defense is quite a bit more beat up yet, like as in both Griffin and Dunbar might be out. And if Dunbar's out, well, even if it's just Griffin, like that's really bad. The Seattle defense can only function, even theoretically, if they have those two good boundary corners playing press, like bump heavy coverage. And if you take out Shaq Griffin and replace him with Trey Flowers, that's enough to make them kind of fall apart like they did in the second half of that game again the first time around. And if you have no Dunbar out there, then, you know, it's like maybe it's one of those things that can't get much worse anyway, but I bet it will. Like the guys that they're trying to replace him with just aren't very good. One of them, Lyndon Stevens, isn't even the typical Pete Carroll like corner. Normally, Carroll would try to get by doing like a money guys like Flowers, who are like 6'2", 6'3", with 33-inch arms, so they can kind of basically press cover and hold and things like that. And Lyndon Stevens is this guy who's just kind of nondescript, he has short arms, can't press. So I don't think Pete Carroll has any idea of how to deal with this. I think he's just kind of at a loss with it. And you heard him talk about how we got to get more balanced on offense, we got to run the ball more. I think that's almost like him coming up with the best idea he can think of as far as fixing this defense, that if he's being realistic, he just can't fix it, and he should start thinking completely outside of those terms. So If he tries to run the ball more and not put as much usage in the offense through Russell Wilson, that'll just make them worse, more than likely. So this is at once a game Seattle can still win because Russell Wilson is so good and because the receivers, Metcalf, Lockett, are so good. But it's basically those three guys versus the Cardinals, and the Cardinals aren't exactly like a world beater or anything, but you know, they're an improving team. Kyler Murray is clearly a star quarterback. DeAndre Hopkins clearly works with him in a way with a level of chemistry that very few quarterbacks and receivers do. And it's not like Hopkins even needed that. This is a guy who was really productive with Tom Savage. So this is a game where it just kind of looks like the Cardinals are pretty close to some sort of higher form that, like, you know, they're going to get there eventually, and they might kind of be getting there right now. And if they are, I don't know how a Seahawks team that's trending downward in so many ways is in a good spot. Like, I feel like their odds have to be worse than last time.
Yeah, I think you have that framed perfectly, where, you know, last time you could chalk up a little bit of things just kind of bouncing the Cardinals' way towards getting them that victory on that Sunday nighter. This time around, the Seahawks do feel like they're in much worse shape here. And, you know, Pete Carroll wanting to run the ball a little bit more, that's all well and good, but they don't really have a ton in the way of backfield personnel right now that's at least healthy. So, I mean, Chris Carson is questionable as of the time that we're recording this. Tyler Lockett on the injury report with the knee.
Oh, man, yes. When did this happen?
So, I mean, it's just it's a mess. And like you detailed, I mean, Lockett is on pace to play on Thursday, but I mean, it's at least possible that he's not going to be at 100%. So that's not great. There's just a lot working against the Seahawks right now. And I think that those top two corners being sidelined might be that thing that really pushes this over the edge and makes this a strong Cardinals lean going into Thursday. As far as like any fantasy outlooks beyond the obvious guys, is there anyone that's in a improved or diminished spot here as far as their fantasy outlook is concerned for Thursday?
Well, I assume one or both of Daryl Daniels and Max Williams will play, but it might just be Max Williams because Daryl Daniels didn't practice this week. And those two are both the blocking tight ends for the Cardinals. And I guess, you know, if one of them is out or if both of them is out, maybe the Cardinals just last second call up, I don't know, Jordan Thomas or Evan Bayless. Jordan Thomas is on the Patriots now. I don't know if Evan Bayless is a free agent still, but they might have to call someone up. But if they don't, and if one of Daniels or Williams is out, then Dan Arnold probably is going to have to play something like 20 more snaps than he usually does. And I don't know. Maybe they'll just ask him to block on all those new snaps if he gets them. But he's a guy who's listed at 6'6", 220 or something. And you can't that's a wide receiver. That's not a tight end. So if they want to call those run plays that they usually do with Daryl Daniels and Max Williams with Dan Arnold, that might go badly. So maybe they won't run quite those same plays. And I don't know, maybe Dan Arnold can capitalize somehow, or maybe it even results in a few extra snaps for someone like Isabella. I don't really know, but basically this looks like it should be a game where the Seahawks lack enough on defense that the Cardinals can just kind of do what they want, which is especially get Hopkins and Kirk and at least one of the running backs going. But if there's a peculiar usage shift in the personnel, I guess it would be at tight end with the Cardinals.
Interesting. No, that's a good call with both of those tight ends being banged up. That would certainly change the Cardinals' ability to run. On the other side, do you have any insights on this Seahawks backfield?
No, and it could be a pretty important question, because if Pete Carroll has decided we got to run the ball more, then he's probably going to try to do that no matter how perceived it is. And it seems like Travis Homer's pretty well beat up, and DJ Dallas, of course, Homer's doubtful, so he's probably out. DJ Dallas has been playing a lot. I don't know if the results are... Carlos Hyde is cleared from it. So, yeah, he's going to probably have to start, because Chris Carson, I don't think, is going to play with that foot. Mm-hmm. So Carlos Hyde, he has to start. Yeah. And he would imagine get like, 15 carries in this game, maybe more. And the more part probably depends on whether the Seahawks can basically get a lead, because no matter if even last year and the years before, Pete Carroll and Schottenheimer would have to ditch their stupid little run heavy plan in the fourth quarter all the time anyways, because they needed Russell Wilson to catch back up for them. So that part is, basically the 2019 is the worst case scenario here for the Seahawks offense. But it is in play, and even that 2019 offense would be worse if it's Carlos Hyde instead of Chris Carson getting those touches.
Absolutely. So that's a tough break as far as the Seahawks backfield is concerned. I don't know if they'll be able to get it in gear, and hopefully, the let Russ cook mantra can continue, and they don't just try to like revert this to like you said, that 2019 form where they're just kind of running into a brick wall and letting the defense know that they're just going to run the ball and not really posing a lot of threats other than that sort of thing. So hopefully this game lives up to the billing. I'm a little bit worried after talking with you about the Seahawks' ability to hold up in this one, but we'll see. Let's get on over to the Falcons versus Saints matchup this weekend. The Saints 4.5-point favorites in this one, down from 5.5 earlier. It's Jameis time, so I want to start things off there. What do you think of Jameis this weekend?
Peyton said he's for sure going with Jameis. I don't know. I thought Peyton was going to kind of like not really tell us kind of thing. And I can't figure this out from my end, because I just don't see how you reconcile the two directions that these two guys go in. Because as much as the Drew Brees Taysom Hill thing kind of worked in its own way, there's such a big difference between Brees and Winston that at the very least you're going to have to change some stuff. Like, this isn't going to be just like you plug in Winston and he behaves like Drew Brees. That's not an option. Not realistically. No,
they're like polar opposites really in terms of their play style.
Yeah. So it's like, on the one hand, Taysom Hill can't throw the ball. And I know a lot of people have their hopes up otherwise, but he couldn't throw the ball at BYU. So don't worry. He can't throw it in the NFL either. But the thing is, he might be closer to the kind of throws that Brees makes, i.e. underneath and never down or rarely downfield anyway. So maybe Taysom Hill full time is closer to the prior offense than Jameis Winston in any real capacity being involved. And in season, I don't know how you reimagine an offense like that. Like, it's one thing to cut out a piece of the playbook and make it just a more, we're only using the Taysom Hill plays now. Like, that's something that you could do. I don't think you can just say, hey guys, please attach your Jameis Winston component to the playbook and get all that in this week. Doesn't seem realistic to me. So, but they could still choose to just go with Winston and have him be a bad version of the Drew Brees function in the offense. I don't know. It's all up to Sean Payton, and he's not telling us. But I feel like the smarter thing for him to do would kind of just be like go with Taysom Hill in a limited offense. But that also that sounds bad to me, because I wouldn't want Taysom Hill to be my quarterback in the first place. So I don't know. I don't know where it's going, but. Guess it would be cool if they put in Jameis and he instantly went, 2019 chucking the ball deep, anti-Drew Brees. It's just, I don't know how they could do that. I don't know logistically how it's even possible.
Yeah, that's going to be a tough adjustment. This isn't like handing the reins off to 2019 Teddy Bridgewater. This is a lot different because Winston,
he's the un-caretaker.
Precisely. So it's really tough to know which way this is going to go. And my apologies if I sounded like I knew for sure that Winston was starting. Again, that is a situation that is up in the air. My sense, you know, as an armchair GM here, is that I think over the course of an entire NFL football game, Jameis Winston gives you the better chance to win than totally. Taysom Hill. So I assume that Peyton agrees with that and will go that route, but you don't know for sure.
The Titans beat the Bills in that one game having no practice. Maybe Jameis's problem this entire career was that he had to practice too much, and reducing it to just kind of like a, you know, street ball playing kind of 500 style. Maybe that with no practice is going to bring out the best in him. Is just, you know, raw instincts will serve him better than what happens when he thinks too much or something like that.
Yes, that's an excellent storyline to bake in there. And then as far as the Saints skill position guys, how does this affect, or the Breeze injury affect their like fantasy outputs in your mind?
Well, it's one of those things where it kind of depends on the path they choose, because if they put Jameis out there and they try to call the Drew Breeze playbook, it might not go well, but it still is better for the interests of Michael Thomas, Emmanuel Sanders, Jared Cook, whoever it is, probably Kamara, as far as his pass catching. They all would prefer to see Winston just because he's capable of throwing an NFL pass, which I really don't know if Taysom Hill can. So, but if they go with Taysom Hill, it's just kind of, I don't know, maybe one of those pass catchers can do something, but Taysom Hill is not throwing 35 passes. And if he throws more than like 25, maybe you can get around 15 receptions in the game, some like as a team. So I don't know if there's really, maybe Michael Thomas and Alvin Kamara have barely enough room, but they're going to be very touchdown dependent if they're going to get anywhere near their customary level of production, I should say. And in that case, I guess it's like, I feel okay about Kamara because he'll be able to run, and Taysom Hill being unable to throw to receivers probably bodes fine for Kamara. Like maybe it's not better, but it's fine. So he'll be good. And Taysom Hill's running can make Kamara's running a little bit easier, at least if the defense is respecting the Hill part of the fakes. So Kamara's fine, but yeah, I don't know if the receivers have much theoretical room. Taysom Hill is the quarterback, because so much of the usage is going to go to the ground. He will run a lot.
No, absolutely. And again, like the passing game isn't going to be nearly as high volume as it normally would be with Breeze back there. So yeah, I think if it is the Hill show the entire time, then pushing for even 25 dropbacks might be asking a lot. And you imagine that a lot of those targets will go to Kamara because he presents the easiest one, the one that's been working the most consistently throughout the season. You know, that probably leaves open like 7, maybe 8 targets for Michael Thomas. And, you know, we're probably not going to get the same efficiency out of him as we're used to seeing from like 2019, 2018 form. So,
right.
Yeah, his projection is lower. So, I mean, your season's probably sunk if you had Michael Thomas with your first pick, but it's almost like cruel having to play out the string with him because he's not injured anymore. But like everything else around him has gone to crap, basically, now that he's finally healthy.
Yeah, I don't know what to do with it. Like you said, teams that picked him first probably just are in a rough enough spot that it doesn't matter what he does at this point, but if you're actually dependent on him and still alive somehow, I feel like, yeah, you're just in for more torment, potentially anyway.
Yeah, so not a great setup as far as that is concerned. On the Falcons side of this one, what do we need to know with them attacking the Saints defense?
I'm kind of worried about Calvin Ridley. I don't know. Foot injuries are not good, and I don't know what to make of him being available, or if he's available, how well he can play. And then I also start to wonder, does this sort of empty calorie offense that the Falcons occasionally put up, this kind of just big Matt Ryan passing volume, does that even happen if there's no Ridley? Like, does Julio Jones start to get diminished per target returned because of the defense just flooding his area of the field so much? Like, Russell Gage isn't hurting anyone. Hayden Hurst, he's okay, but if you need him to be your second best pass catcher, your passing game probably isn't very good. So I do worry about Julio losing a little bit, but from the volume projection standpoint, you know, never really would get better for Julio than in days where Calvin Ridley doesn't play or isn't himself, because Calvin Ridley's a double-digit target kind of receiver. So you can't really expect Julio to go like 250 yards on 20 targets, but at least the 20 target part is more likely than in a, you know, another game. So he should be fine. I'm realizing now I'm getting a stale report here. Is Calvin Ridley fine? Sorry, I have to keep asking this stupid stuff.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Ridley is questionable. He was a limited participant in Wednesday's practice. That's what he was.
Okay. Well,
that bodes reasonably well.
Yeah, he should be able to play then. And as long as he's out there, then even though I hate the dirt cutter offense and I don't really believe in the Falcons offense, having Ridley on one side and Julio on the other and Matt Ryan at quarterback, that's legitimately tough to stop. So that part of them is fine, but I don't know if I would expect them to be good necessarily. I don't know. Like there should be those numbers, but I just don't know how competitive they'll be. I can see Julio and Ridley both going for 100 or something, and the Falcons not really getting many touchdowns in the game all the same. So we'll see. The Saints defense has been kind of goofy all year, but I feel like it's been pretty common in the past few years that they get better over the course of the season. And even a guy like Marshawn Lattimore, who's playing terribly this year, it's like, how can that really keep happening forever? It's like, even if he had 10 bad games in a row, it's still true to say that most of his career has been very good. And I feel like a talent like him will eventually pop back up, but that's not something that's likely to happen against these receivers. So I don't know. I guess it should be kind of more or less to your typical expectations for Julio and Ridley. And Gurley, it's kind of like, you know, you got to go with him, I guess, in most leagues just because of how much he paid to get him. But I wouldn't get my hopes, or I would prepare for maybe a disappointment here, because if the Saints go with especially Taysom Hill, that's a good way for Atlanta to trend downward in the play count, and for both teams' play count to trend downward, just because running the ball runs the clock faster than throwing the ball. And you can imagine Sean Payton going like a little lower tempo to kind of preserve a lead and just choke the win out that much quicker, instead of playing with fire that is, you know, Taysom Hill and his turnover potential. So I'm not getting my hopes up for like a higher range outcome with these guys. Like, I don't think I'll go with this game in DFS, for instance.
Okay, yeah, this is by Falcon Saints standards like a relatively low projected total. I mean, it's just sitting at 50, hasn't gotten higher than 52 at any point this week, and is trending downwards, in fact. So yeah, I think that there's a very real possibility that if the Saints go that ball control route, then that's going to really, really limit the play count on both sides. And therefore, you know, what would normally be a game that you kind of like start your DFS builds with in normal times is one to maybe stay away from. We have Todd Gurley projected like at like our number 19 running back for this week. He's running back 20 on DraftKings. So yeah, kind of low end RB2 type of projection for him, but it could be worse if the carries get cut into a little bit. And I am a little bit interested now that the Saints have Kwon Alexander. They have a really like nice run stopping ability too on top of things that they've added this season. So maybe that makes it even tougher for Gurley on Sunday.
Yeah, and there is a way for Gurley to have a good game, but it needs, I think, the scenario of the Saints offense collapsing to the point that the Saints defense does too. It's like, even if the Saints offense struggles, it's like the Kwon Alexander addition cannot hurt. So DeMario Davis is already really good. They got a bunch of guys who are capable of playing really well. And you know, with that being the case, we have to keep in mind, like, they might have all of a sudden just kind of get better over the course of the year too. So yeah, I'm not optimistic for Gurley, especially since it's in New Orleans rather than Atlanta. It's like, stupid quarterback situation or not, I don't really want to play the Saints there. So especially when it's a team as dysfunctional, as capable of just failing for no reason as the Falcons are.
Yeah, they are top notch at that. Let's move on to another game. We got the Panthers going up against the Lions. A lot of unknowns in this one, and that's why the things like the over-unders and the money lines aren't out right now at several different sports books. You got Stafford with the banged-up thumb, Golladay and Hockenson both on the injury report this week. They're both questionable as of the time of this recording. McCaffrey is going to be out on the Carolina side of things. Teddy Bridgewater dealing with that MCL injury. We don't know if he's going to be able to go, or if he does play, how effective he will be. So, and he's been moving around a decent bit this year, running the ball a little bit. So if that gets taken out, then that certainly hurts the Panthers offense as well. So a lot of question marks in this game more than anything else.
Yeah, this is pretty gross. I guess we can kind of maybe start to get and keep our hopes up for DeAndre Swift, because particularly with the shorthandedness of the Detroit offense, it's going to be difficult for Patricia to justify any shenanigans of, you know, keeping the ball away from Swift for too long anymore. And it's just obvious. It's like he's there. I think Kenny Golladay is a really good player at receiver, but I expect Swift to be a better running back than Golladay as a receiver. So particularly with these other parts of the offense struggling, beat up, they got to just give him the stupid ball already. And as much as I think the Panthers have some decent players on defense at a few spots, and I think Phil Snow's a pretty good defensive coordinator, I think if you give volume to Swift, he will eventually make a big play against most defenses. And certainly I don't think the Panthers are talented exactly on defense. I think they're kind of like overachieving, and overachievement tends to lose against top level talent with enough exposure. So I feel good about Swift's chances regardless of what happens at quarterback. But yeah, it would be better for him if, you know, Stafford is out there and Galladay's out there at like 85 and Hawkinson's out there at 85. That would be a good setup for Swift. But on the Panther side, I don't know what, you know, Mike Davis, sure, and those receivers if you want to, but I wouldn't get my hopes up. PJ Walker looks pretty terrible so far, and I don't know what we can expect from Bridgewater realistically.
Well, we'll always have that XFL run, right? Or was it the AAF or XFL for Walker?
I didn't actually get in on the AAF thing or the XFL, but I do remember, and I sincerely appreciate Temple PJ Walker. Him and Robbie Anderson there like 6 years ago were awesome.
Yes, that is a fact, and they can never take that away from us. But as far as this coming NFL Sunday, if Walker's out there, then best of luck.
Maybe Anderson, but yeah, everybody else is kind of looking a little risky.
Yes, very risky. But circling it back, before we move on to this one or move on to the next game, I know this is a rather quick breakdown of this game, but again, so many unknowns at the time of the recording, not a whole lot of actionable stuff we can give you at this stage, but I'm glad that you know you gave the stamp of approval as far as like the Swift breakout happening. You know, it felt like in that Jacksonville game, like, okay, here we go. And then we had frustrating usage patterns those next following weeks. But now we're really at the stage coming off another big game from Swift to where he has to be the engine of that run game. And he's so effective as a pass catcher out of the backfield, too. I don't know how you can really justify, other than just like to give Swift a breather, giving any snaps away to carry on Johnson or Adrian Peterson the rest of the way.
Yeah. Knock on wood anyway, because I mean, it's all so stupid. Like, carry on Johnson, who I never particularly liked as a prospect, is still way better than Adrian Peterson. So the whole Peterson thing is just so tedious and silly. And Patricia will always be the kind of fool to make us deal with things like this. I just think with the conditions as they are, it'll be especially tough to do that. Like, I think he would like to be this ridiculous, you know, tinkering fool who thinks he's doing three-dimensional chess by putting out his slowest and crappiest running back in like the highest stakes situations. I don't know on what reasoning he's doing it. Always want to do that. That's just who he is. It's just, I don't know if he even someone like him feels like it's an option in a situation like this one.
Yeah, so it's got to be Swift season. There's really no other way around it at this stage. Let's get on over to Eagles-Browns. Kind of an interesting matchup, kind of like the two teams kind of paralleling each other within their respective conferences, but the Eagles slightly better chance at the playoff just because of how much in shambles the East is right now. We got the Browns checking in as 3-point favorites in this one. How do these two teams match up against each other?
I don't know. I hate the Eagles so much, and it's such a bummer because it's like Frank Reich and Doug Peterson were these two guys 4 years ago. I don't even remember when they won that stupid Super Bowl.
2017.
Yeah, it's like these were guys who, as recently as 3 years ago, were kind of never confused for like a Belichick or even a Shanahan or McVay type. I think we knew they weren't that good, but I think they seemed like good coaches. You know, like, we know a bad coach, at least after enough time seeing them, we know when a coach is just kind of bad. And I thought Doug Peterson and Frank Reich were this sort of in between where they're pretty good. These guys who are good enough to win a Super Bowl, and they won't make a dynasty, maybe like Belichick or whoever else that's capable of that, but they'd be something closer to good than bad. And whatever it was that made them seem that way is gone now. There's not anything to Doug Peterson as a coach. He's just kind of flailing these different ways. And I, you know, Frank Reich, he's kind of doing a different version of dumb things in Indianapolis right now, but they both just like they've been passed by already by the league. Like time already has like moved past them, and they either can't catch up or they're going to need a lot more time to figure out things. The Eagles are trending downward, though. There's not any growth here. There's nothing to build upon. There's no insight that Doug Peterson is offering to find their way through this sort of dark stretch here.
He'll just go for two. He'll go for two, though.
He'll go for two, and he'll, you know, that's the most going forward on fourth down and going for two is all you can really ask for a coach. As long as they do that, their results are good. To me, but like it's just like I don't think Carson Wentz is a very good quarterback or whatever. I think he's fine, but those results last week, you know, it's always just something's going wrong. It's like if Carson Wentz isn't missing the open guy, then
he's
that guy
into a sack.
Well, he's running into a sack, or the guy drops it like Miles Sanders last week, and they're adding guys like Jalen Reagor to the offense, and they're adding Miles Sanders to the offense, and they get worse. Like who's running this team? How do you do that? It's a complete lack of composure. Whereas at least when they were, you know, making the Super Bowl and winning that Super Bowl against the Patriots, the Eagles were kind of like composed and seemed dignified or something. They're starting to look like they don't practice anymore this year. And I just can't imagine, like, I can't even theorize as to how they look so goofy as they have, but I'm not optimistic about it. Going to Cleveland doesn't make me any more optimistic for them. I don't know if Carson Wentz can deal with Myles Garrett, Larry Ogunjobi, and Sheldon Richardson right now. That Cleveland defensive line can really make things go wrong if that stupid Giants defense can hit Carson Wentz 12 times or whatever it was last week. It's like they don't even try to rush the passer. They say our defense is going to be three guys who are 350 pounds and can't move. That's going to be our building block right here. And the Eagles offensive line just like matadored them. And it was just ridiculous. So Myles Garrett and Sheldon Richardson, those guys are both like blue chip talents. It can go pretty wrong in that regard. I don't know how much hope to have for Miles Sanders. Like, I think he's good in fantasy and he's more or less good in real life, but he's pretty limited as a running back actually. Like, he has these sort of just weak spots in his game that become pretty ugly from time to time, and he'll never be confused for the kind of pure running talent who can kind of like create space and traffic. It's like he needs space and he can run through space when he has it, but you put a little stress on him and he kind of just turns into the baseline of the offense, which in the Eagles' case is trash right now. So I feel a lot more confident in the Browns side because they at least have an offensive line and they have two running backs who can run the ball. And I know the Eagles are tough against the run a lot of the time, but their linebacker play has been pretty bad this year. And their defensive line is good, deep, whatever. But if you have a really good run-blocking offensive line, then that kind of neutralizes that. And then if it's your linebackers and your tacklers generally against Chubb and Hunt, it's like, well, I'll take that team then.
No, exactly. And I think the Browns' offensive line got a little bit healthier this past week. I think the drumming movie, that guy is also playing offensive line for the Browns now. But no, he's back in the fold. That definitely helps that run game that was already very effective. So, yeah, I think that this all points to the Browns being able to play their 2020 brand of football. And to your larger point on the Eagles, it's really gone so sideways. And I think if you're an Eagles fan, you're almost more disturbed after last week than you have been at any other point in the season, because at least you could point to the injuries previously. But now, like you said it perfectly, like you get Miles Sanders and Jalen Reagor back and you get worse. Like that is an alarming instance.
Also,
and maybe it was just one game, but I wouldn't feel confident in saying that.
they've, in hindsight, not really known what they've been doing for a while, because we should have – I know I made this mistake. When they took Jalen Hurts, I was like, well, you know, they're the Eagles. They do a pretty good job of managing things. I'm sure they've got some good ideas, some plan for this. And it turned out, no, they made that pick because they're just confused. They don't know what to do. They're fundamentally just detached from the nature of you know, the challenges that are ahead of them. And they're distracted by these other things that don't matter, and they're just, you know, sinking the whole time that they're wasting their time on all these things. So the Jalen Hurts plays are just ridiculous. The theory of it makes no sense. It's interesting to have an added threat and a given look when you can fold that threat into a prior look. If you have to take Carson Wentz off the field to put Jalen Hurts at quarterback, no one's going like, oh, what are they going to do now? They could do anything. No, they know that you're going to do some stupid run play, because that's the only reason you put him on the field, is because he runs better than Carson Wentz. So it's just a dumb thing. It doesn't, it's like the Taysom Hill thing, but even worse applied. It's, I mean, just it's stuff you do when you don't know what you're doing.
Very similar to like Lamar Jackson rookie year.
Oh yeah. Marty Morningwig ideas over here.
That's not great. And then one last optical thing when it comes to the Eagles. If you've watched them at all this month, do you get like tripped up watching Carson Wentz because he's wearing like the camo sleeve and it kind of looks like he's got a crazy arm sleeve of tattoos? Or is that just me?
I've definitely seen those, and I think it's a weird, you know, fashion choice or whatever, but I'm more so just struck by kind of the eeriness of it all. It's just a weird thing to watch all these people who are basically the same people as a couple of years ago, who looked really good, and nothing really changed. It's like they've got a case of just terminal team yips. Like, they're just doing bad things all the time, and you can kind of just like feel the failure in the air when you're watching them. And when that's something that comes across to you when you're watching the Giants play, like, oh wow, this team across the aisle from Daniel Jones seems kind of, you know, disheveled and irresponsible today. Like, that's just a bad place to be. Like, you cannot be as a team more dysfunctional than Daniel Jones ever. And especially if you're supposed to be like a division leader or whatever.
No, absolutely not. So this is just more tough stuff from the Eagles.
I hate the Eagles here. I like the Browns to, yeah, just kind of like ruin their spirit, actually.
Okay. I do want to know, because it feels like forever ago that crazy Cincinnati game happened for Cleveland with, you know, all the touchdowns, Odell Beckham going out in that game. The last 2 weeks that and they've had a bye sandwiched in, so that kind of makes it feel longer than it has been. It's only been two games of sample really since then, but going up against Vegas and Houston, both in very windy conditions. We saw the takes following the Beckham injury, saying, you know, like Rashard Higgins or I was saying like DPJ might be worth a look, that sort of thing. But we got another outdoor game here in Philly. Then they got a couple, you know, non-weather games coming up after that at Jacksonville and at Tennessee. But are there any sort of like fancy takeaways for the receivers beyond Jarvis Landry at this point? Or should we just expect this to be like a non-fantasy offense as far as that goes, and it's only the run game?
Well, I still think Rashard Higgins is good, and I think as long as there isn't bad wind, then even in this sort of, you know, bad passing offense, there should be room for him in PPR to function. I don't think Stefanski has any sort of insight as to how to use Austin Hooper, so I think Hooper's still good, and I think if Stefanski makes the choice to use him, then it's pretty simple. He'll go, but I think Stefanski was either like not a part of that signing or just is too confused about talent evaluation to know what he's doing with him, and I therefore wouldn't have much hope for the rest of the year in that case. So I think it's like in this particular game against the Eagles, we might see Slay shadow Rashard Higgins, just because as much as I would like to see Higgins in the slot, Landry's going to play the slot until they terminate that contract. So he's going to be in the slot. Slay usually doesn't go there. So I think you can feel pretty good about Jarvis Landry in this game. And if you have to use Rashard Higgins, I wouldn't exactly over it, because he's pretty good. And if Baker Mayfield throws 35 passes, I would guess, eight or nine or 10 targets is in play for Higgins. So if you're talking that kind of usage, then you don't worry about efficiency anymore, really.
Sure. Now, that's a good point. When it comes to volume, we'll have to see if the Browns go that approach. That obviously hasn't been viable the last couple of weeks because of the weather in Cleveland. We'll see what's going on there come Sunday. That should impact the outlook as far as those pass catchers are concerned in Cleveland. Let's get on over to Patriots going up against the Texans. Patriots coming off the strong win on Sunday night against Baltimore. The Texans, a very just kind of sleepy loss to Cleveland, I thought, last week. It didn't feel like there was a whole lot working on either side for the Texans in this one. So it's not shocking to me that even though this isn't a good Patriots team, that they're still favored on the road.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think Deshaun Watson can beat this defense, and I think even kind of the bad Bill O'Brien playbook might be able to do okay against this sort of defense, because the ways that they always failed, especially with, you know, relative to the standards of guys like Watson and those receivers, especially at the time with Hopkins, to me it looked like the reason it would fail is because defenses more or less knew the route combos that they were using. So you're not actually going to cover a guy if you don't have to. You'll just wait where you know he's going to go and not, you know, trouble yourself with mirroring him. Just wait a second over here, because we know he goes over here when the plays look like before the snap. And so I thought that was part of the problem. But the Patriots use enough man coverage, or at least they did when you know Gilmore was healthy. I don't know if they're kind of shifting away from that to account for the durability troubles at corner. But if you're playing like press man coverage against Deshaun Watson, then I don't think even Bill O'Brien's playbook can hurt him, because you're specifically reducing it to that corner versus that receiver. And if that's the task, if that's the scenario, then it's like Brandon Cooks will beat most corners. Will Fuller will beat most corners. Maybe neither of them can beat J.C. Jackson, but J.C. Jackson is only one corner. And there should be someone getting open. And Deshaun Watson, I think his kind of downfield attack instincts really suit a matchup against aggressive press man coverage. So if the Patriots play it that way, I think Watson can be pretty good here. And that's, you know, I don't want to take that for granted, because maybe Bill Belichick thinks these things too and is like, oh, well, we'll just use more zones against him. It's all possible. But I do like this matchup a lot more for Watson than playing in wins like last week's.
Okay. That last week was going to be tough on both sides as far as moving the ball through the air. Like you said, J.C. Jackson is doing extremely well right now, but just one guy. Maybe Stephon Gilmore gets back in the mix and makes things a little bit tougher on these Texans receivers. But I think you had it drawn up pretty well as far as how the Texans can beat the Patriots when they have the ball. We'll just see if they're able to actually get that done. As far as the Patriots are concerned, I thought Damian Harris looked awesome on Sunday night.
Yeah.
So how does he profile against this Texans run D?
Well, he's running pretty well. And unlike a case like a Benny Snell or an Alexander Mattison or whatever, I actually can get pretty high on Damian Harris as a guy who's kind of, you know, this sort of a pure, well, not that Madison is a pure runner, but just that kind of like non-blue chip, high motor kind of power sort of runner. These guys who fall outside the first round, but they kind of just impress you with the motor that they run with. I like Harris a lot more than the other two in this category, because we've already seen him produce at a high level at Alabama, and including ahead of Josh Jacobs producing at a high level at Alabama. So for me, this is something, Harris running like he has in the past month is something that I kind of expected from him based on what he did in college and his workout numbers, which, by the way, are better than Madison and Snell too. Like, Harris is a pretty good athlete. He's not great, but he's basically like a Josh Jacobs at worst kind of athlete. You know, like it's he's not bad.
That works.
Yeah, and he's running with a really hot motor right now. I don't know how much he can keep running at like 110%, but if they keep his work kind of narrowly defined, you know, like if he's not really doing this pass catching stuff, it's at once kind of a doubt. It's kind of a bummer for fantasy purposes, because we want him to get targets. But it's like maybe part of why he's doing so well is because he just does go into the game, you know, basically blindfolded and just like runs with this maximum intensity. And it's playing really well. It seems to be, you know, complementing the sequences of the other plays that they call in that offense. So I think he's shown that he's better than Sony Michel. And I think not only can you kind of be optimistic about Harris in any game where Michel is out, you know, including this one, but you can kind of, I, I think you can kind of assume that Sony Michel is just about over in this offense. I don't know why. I don't know if they could bring him back. You know, it's like, even if they wanted to get him involved, like, what are you going to do? Like, deactivate James White, Rex Burkhead? It's like, they both play bigger roles in this offense than Sony Michel would off the bench. So I think this one's kind of a wrap. It's just Harris who's the runner there now.
And he gets another opportunity to prove that, in my opinion, this week. Assuming the ankle is good to go, and like you said, all those details with how he's running right now, just a little bit of added lighter fuel here. Texans allowing 5.2 yards per carry to opposing offenses. So that's worst in the league. That's worst in the Bengals. That ain't good. So going up against an offense that I think is going to try to run the ball more than most other teams, this just sets up as a very good spot for Harris and a tough one for the Texans. That you know, the worst part of their defense is going to be the one that is exploited the most by this Patriots attack. Anything else to add on here before we move on?
I think you could feel good about Cam Newton too. Maybe not so much as a passer, but if Harris is helping them move the chains, then eventually, you know, the defense has to lean forward. And if Cam's getting a little help, then I think Cam can do well in most cases. And this defense is more friendly than most.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Let's get on over. Titans, Ravens. Titans 6-point underdogs on the road here, going up against Baltimore. Baltimore kind of in shambles offensively right now. And I think that you also run into a situation where they've been without Ronnie Stanley the last couple of weeks. That's been known. They've been without Marshall Yanda all season. Of course, he retired this past offseason. I think that the loss of Nick Boyle is going to be like maybe the final nail in the coffin of whatever this Ravens offense is trying to be. Because, I mean, I would have the usage or like the value on basically any other team that he does with the Ravens, but he basically functions as like a sixth offensive lineman who can also catch the ball for them. So with him being out, and no Hayden Hurst, it just means that there's one real NFL tight end, and it's Mark Andrews. Obviously, Mark Andrews is great in the pass catching role. He's okay as a blocker, but that's not his primary function. You need multiple tight ends that can block to make this offense really go. I think we can kind of deduce that if you compare it to last year. So I think this Ravens offense is in deep trouble, and it's going to stay that way all year.
Yeah, I mean, relative to last year, there's just nothing they can do to get to that kind of point. Like, there's no candidates. There's no one on the bench to turn to, and they have no means, you know, trade or signing or whatever to replace the personnel that they lost, especially a guy like Stanley at a time like they did. I can't believe they haven't added a tight end yet, just like any free agents, because they don't.
I think they got Luke Wilson.
Oh, Luke Wilson, the Seattle guy. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I think, they're going to have to call him up, and he's going to have to play like 30 snaps right away, because Mark Andrews just doesn't block. And Boyle had been running more routes this year than previous years. So that's kind of interesting to me too. As much as we're focusing on like Yanda and recently Stanley and a little bit before that, we were kind of looking at like Willie Snead and Boykin as maybe not doing their fair share kind of. There's been a change in how they use the tight ends generally this year. Like, I guess Andrews has been more or less the same as he was previously, but he's been doing more snaps than last year. And Boyle has been playing about the same snaps, but he's been blocking less. He's been running a lot more routes than he used to. So I don't know what to make of that, really. I generally hate the idea of blocking tight ends, but it is interesting to me that regardless of all these other things that have changed, that one changed on their own choice. Like, and it wasn't just because they got rid of Hurst. Like, they could have kept Boyle blocking as much as last year, and they didn't. So I don't know what that might indicate about their broader strategy. In any case, as much as they can't really fix it, especially in terms of like meeting the expectations that we had for them this offseason, this is one setting where I think it's going to be just fine. And in fact, if Lamar Jackson has fewer than 30 fantasy points in this game, I think I'll be shocked, because I know he had a problem against the Titans in the playoffs. I know they totally, you know, just punched the Ravens in the face, and they never recovered from early in that game. But the Tennessee defense sucks this year. It's absolutely trash. And if it's a trash defense, then I'm not worried about Lamar Jackson and the Ravens offense against a trash defense. Like, this is an offense that I specifically hoped to be one of the best in the NFL. So the disappointment comes when they have games like last week or you know, whatever, a couple weeks ago. But when they're going against a team like the Titans defense,
I don't get so anxious because it's I don't need them to reach the same heights that I hoped for previously. The bar is much lower now, and this Tennessee defense is vulnerable to a guy like Marquise Brown, even though he's been struggling. Like the one dimension that they've been kind of using up too fast with Marquise Brown, like these, you know, they go deep and they give him curls. That's basically all that they've done, and now defenses have flooded to his side. I don't know if this defense can stop even this kind of poor application of Marquise Brown or Mark Andrews. I guess it's a little easier for Jayon Brown or Kevin Byard to cover Andrews, but I just don't know if it's enough. And at corner, they don't have anybody. Well, Adoree Jackson might be back, I guess I should say. But even if Adoree Jackson is back, and even if Adoree Jackson covers Marquise Brown well, I think Miles Boykin can get open on the other corner. And I especially think Devin DuVernay can. And I also think these running backs can run on the Tennessee offense. So I think Lamar has a big game here. And I don't know what to expect of the Tennessee side other than, you know, they'll try to run it with Henry. They'll probably have some success. I think you can feel okay about A.J. Brown in this game. Maybe he gets shadowed by Humphrey, maybe not. But I like the idea of A.J. Brown coming off of a bad game, especially when we call it a bad game. I think there was interference on that pass that he dropped that everyone freaked out about that could have been a touchdown. It's like he got interfered with, and that should have been a call. So if we're one pass interference that goes uncalled away from A.J. Brown having another 70 yards and a touchdown, then I kind of like, you know, obviously you're playing him season long. It's just I mean to say if there is a Lamar Jackson kind of breakout game here, then I wouldn't mind having a share of A.J. Brown in a tournament lineup or two.
And one more tournament dart to throw out there. Maybe this will be music to your ears. Maybe I think it will. Devin DuVernay has been playing more and more every single week. I think he had his season high as far as snap share was concerned this past week against the Patriots. Caught everything thrown his way. You know, that's not uncommon for him at this stage. So meanwhile, Miles Boykin, his snap share continues to go downward. So I think that I don't have his DFS price pulled up right in front of me, but DuVernay, interesting. If you're buying, you know, the Lamar Jackson bounce back, then I think DuVernay is a big part of it actually come Sunday.
Yeah, good call. He actually played 17 more snaps than Boykin. So I guess it's finally happened.
It's happening, brother. I'm the Ravens like backup beat writer here at RotoWire, so I pay attention to these sort of things.
It's
so
happening, isn't it?
It's freaking happening, brother. So that's exciting at the very least. If nothing else, is very exciting about the Ravens right now. Let's get on to
before we get over to our next game. We got a message from our friends over at PropSwap. Smart sports bettors always know where to find the best odds before placing a bet, and that's why smart bettors use PropSwap. You can always find the best odds on PropSwap because you're buying directly from other bettors like yourself. See a ticket you like, but think the price is too high? Submit a bid for a price you think is fair, then buy it. PropSwap sellers are always willing to negotiate, and we all know bookies never will. And for a limited time, our listeners can get up to $500 in bonus cash. Just use the promo code ROTO500. That's promo code ROTO 500, and PropSwap will match your first deposit up to $500. Become a smarter sports bettor today. Go to PropSwap.com or download the PropSwap app. We also got a message from our friends over at BetMGM. Sports bettors know that magic happens when you turn a hunch into action and apply the right amount of expertise. That's why BetMGM has teamed up with RotoWire to offer new BetMGM customers a free 6-month RotoWire subscription when they place their first bet. Register on the BetMGM app or website, and once you make your first sports wager, you'll receive a season's length of RotoWire's unmatched sports insights. Find out why BetMGM is the king of sportsbooks by signing up and placing your first bet today. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. And just a reminder, 21 years of age or older to wager. Colorado, Indiana, New Jersey, and Nevada, Tennessee, and West Virginia only. Please gamble responsibly. And if you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700 in Colorado and Nevada, and 1-800-GAMBLER. That's 1-800-GAMBLER in New Jersey and West Virginia. In Tennessee, call or text the red line at 800-889-9789. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. 9 with it in Indiana. Promotional code not available in Nevada. And up next,
we got the Steelers 10-point favorites in this one going up against the Jags. What do you make of this one?
Well, if the Steelers use their whole blitz playbook, I know I keep saying Luton sucks and Luton keeps doing okay. I thought he did okay against the Packers. I should mention, like, his numbers were really bad, but so was the wind. He still isn't a starting quarterback to me or anything close to it, but he's done better than I thought he would. And he's got some moxie or whatever, so that's great. But if the Pittsburgh defense is playing, you know, full form, I think we might see some kind of embarrassing footage for Luton, like just getting, you know, blindside hit and looking like an exploding giraffe when it happens. And it'll be pretty rough if so. But the Steelers could look at this team, you know, 10-point underdogs and think instead, like, let's save some of the playbook for the, you know, the AFC. And that would be reasonable. So, you know, 10 points might be asking a lot of the Steelers just because, you know, if they'd have to throw the ball all game. And wouldn't it be a little weird if they threw the ball all game? I don't know. It seems like James Conner, I think, is probably okay, but he couldn't get anything going last week. And granted, they didn't
come out much, on him right now.
They didn't give him much volume, but it just doesn't really feel like it's happening. And they've clearly changed some of the offense to suit Roethlisberger, where I think some of the usage, especially the usage 2 years ago in the passing game that went to Conner at the time, has now been channeled into these kind of like, it's been given to like Chase Claypool, I think. And obviously it's not the same plays. It's not these backfield screens, but it's just the Steelers are running, I think, a lot of four wide this year when they used to run, you know, three wide, one tight end, or two tight end, two receiver on plays that turned into targets for James Conner. I think they're going to Chase Claypool and to a lesser extent Eric Ebron now. And it's like Anthony McFarland was getting worked in a little bit before he got sick last week. Benny Snell can do some stuff. Jalen Samuels can do some stuff. So it's hard to be excited about Conner the way I should be if he's a 10-point favorite against a bad defense. I don't know. Maybe I can't make a call on that one because it does look like a really good setup. And maybe I'm just despairing over, you know, a missed opportunity like last week too much. Like maybe he's due for a bounce back. But it seems like the Steelers, to me, are doing something kind of similar to what the Colts are doing with Phillip Rivers, where it's like everything they do is to justify the quarterback. And they know Roethlisberger can't throw downfield, so they are hellbent, somewhat understandably, on making a horizontally wide field every play because they can't make it vertically long. So they're creating the space left to right instead. And, you know, you got to get a fifth receiver out there sometimes to do that. And so, yeah, it's even if the Steelers cover the spread and then some, it's hard to get my hopes up for a vintage James Conner like ever again, really.
Yeah. He's one of like the biggest question marks for fantasy this week, because, you know, all the numbers would point to, you know, him just crushing it in this spot against the Jags. But we've had plenty of opportunities like that before this season, and it hasn't really come to fruition too much when it comes to Conner. So I think you have a good, interesting parallel as far as Steelers justifying the quarterback situation right now and trying to tailor it as much as they can to fit Roethlisberger's strengths as they currently set up. And with that, a lot of just short intermediate passes, it's kind of like the bread and butter of this offense. As far as the Jags are concerned in this one, I mean, it's one thing to kind of hang around with the Packers. And I know there was at least one special teams touchdown that kind of helped the Jaguars stick around on Sunday. This time going up against the Steelers defense, I think that, you know, we could see a very, very low scoring outcome for the Jaguars offense.
Yeah, I don't like Luton against this defense. I don't think he has the quick release ability. I don't think he has a quick game to counter what's coming for him. If you're trying to do that play action, you know, deep post fly route stuff over and over against the Steelers, one of those times you're just not going to block TJ Watt or somebody, and it's just going to go really badly. So I think the Jags, I don't know. It's like, I like James Robinson. I wouldn't put it past him running tough in this game. I just don't know whether it would matter. Like you can imagine this game being like 17-0 at halftime. And if the Jags have to throw the ball in the second half, eventually Luton will just fall apart, I think.
Yeah, that'll be a tough scenario. I think pretty much any situation that you put it up against, I just don't really see Luton succeeding here. So that's just going to be tough sledding for basically all these Jaguars. And you know, this is among one of the tougher spots that James Robinson will face this year. I don't know if you have better options on your bench. If you do, then you're probably doing very, very well in your league right now. But you know, I think that Robinson still profiles as probably a middle range RB2 this week, just because of the volume that he's going to get. So like him, all right, but otherwise nothing really to look at as far as the Jags go, as far as I'm concerned. Let's move on over. We got the Bengals going up against the football team, number one versus number two picks from a year ago, Burrow versus Chase Young. What do you got going on here?
I don't know. This is a tough one. It looks like Mixon is out again, so it'll be Geo, and I guess to a lesser extent, Samaje Perine revenge game. So that's I guess my interest in this game.
There you go.
But on the other side, on the other parts of the Bengals offense, some people are starting to notice more. I don't know how much it's being properly appreciated yet, though. T. Higgins is not just the best receiver on the Bengals. Well, yeah, actually, I know Tyler Boyd is really good, but T. Higgins is already, I think, pushing for kind of like top 20-ish sort of NFL receiver, which is at once pretty surprising for me. Like, I didn't see him making this much ground in such a crowded wide receiver rotation. But, you know, Ross is out. Auden Tate really just isn't much. I know I've seen people saying, like, they should replace A.J. Green with Auden Tate. That's just kind of like replacing Auden Tate with Auden Tate. I don't know. It's like, it's just not really a change. Like, go ahead. Who cares? It's not going to change anything. This is a T. Higgins show. It's a Tyler Boyd show. That's not changing. And as much as Kendall Fuller has done really well with Washington, and Ronald Darby's having a kind of like a bounce back year, neither of those guys is suited to covering Higgins really at all. And I don't know if they're not really suited to cover A.J. Green either, or Auden Tate, but they definitely can't cover Higgins, in my opinion. And Tyler Boyd should be good in the slot. So if Higgins is an advantage and if Boyd is an advantage, then that's kind of interesting for Burrow, even though that Washington pass rush could be a big problem. And that's the part that makes me confused with this matchup. Like, I don't really know how to game that one out, because I think Burrow can make the throws. I think those receivers can create the throwing lanes for him, but I just, you know, 2 weeks doesn't make me forget how bad that Cincinnati offensive line has been this year. And if they've had two better games, then that just makes me all that much more inclined to think it's going to fall apart again. And if they're going to play this front four, I am pretty worried about Joe Burrow getting hit a lot of times by, you know, three times each from Young, Montez Sweat, Darren Payne, Jonathan Allen. So those four guys can all just destroy the offensive linemen in front of them, and they could all do it at the same time. There's ways for it to go very badly for Burrow, but those receivers will be open, and I don't know which happens first, you know?
Right. That is like the key to this game, because we've seen Washington take over games the times that they've won this year or been competitive. It's been in part because of that pass rush that they have. I mean, the week one against the Eagles is the most obvious example of that. But yeah, it goes to show that this is a pass rush that can really tilt a game, and the Bengals are particularly vulnerable to those type of setups. So even if they have been playing better, like you said recently, it feels a little bit false, and it feels like it's due for some pretty serious regression come Sunday. I think that what will smooth it over and make the fantasy values work for guys like Higgins and Boyd and all of that is just like I think the Bengals passing volume, especially with no Mixon, is going to be high enough to satisfy at least Higgins and Boyd for your fantasy purposes. But
yeah.
I don't necessarily see this being like a bust out spot, because like you said, the pass rush and like the secondary has actually been decent, I guess, for Washington too.
Yeah, their secondary is fine. I just think like Kim 5'11", 185 kind of corner, and Darby, he's bigger, but he's still more of he's sub 6 foot, sub 195, that kind of stuff. And T. Higgins is just huge. He moves really well. but he's huge. And in the slot, it should be, I think, Tyler Boyd against Jimmy Moreland, who, you know, he was James Madison corner 2 years ago or something. Like, he can't cover Tyler Boyd. So I'm optimistic about Boyd, especially since he has the quicker routes. But I think Higgins will get he'll even if he needs to box out Fuller or Darby or somebody, I think he'll do it. I think he's just a star receiver, and he'll keep doing stuff like that.
Absolutely. And then on the Washington side of things, you know,
I don't know. I what hate can this we team take so from?
Well, he threw it so much last week, though. That, I mean, but so
yeah,
much
Terry's great. Terry cannot be stopped. Antonio Gibson is good, but he can be stopped by Ron Rivera, so that's a problem. But the setup is great for Gibson if they just decide to start giving their best players the ball. If you throw 15 targets to J.D. McKissick, and I'm not even blaming J.D. McKissick for that, and I'm slightly blaming the quarterback. I think even if you have a busted leg, you should know better than throwing 15 times to J.D. McKissick in one game.
What, like 40 yards or something?
It was obscene, man. It was the single dumbest usage I've ever seen in an NFL game, and it's the kind of thing that it's like just proof. Ron Rivera has no clue what he's doing. He is a foolish person. You can't let that happen. 15 targets, you just end the game. Like the refs should have called a mercy rule at the 12th target to J.D. McKissick or something like that. They should be like, sorry, you threw it 12 times to J.D. McKissick in one game, so, you know, we have to keep this. It's unethical to let this game continue. But yeah, that's ridiculous. If you're doing that, just quit. You can't win if you give 15 targets to J.D. McKissick. And it's not J.D. McKissick's fault. The coach shouldn't let it happen, you know. But if you put Antonio Gibson out there for a bunch of those 15 targets, that could be the margin that determines them winning the previous week or something. Like, it's crazy the ways that they'll just choose to do the wrong thing the right way. You know, that's what Ron Rivera is all about. It's like doing better than J.D. If you're Antonio Gibson, doing better than J.D. McKissick isn't enough. You need to fail the right way, like J.D. McKissick, instead of winning the wrong way, like Gibson might. And that's just who Ron Rivera is. And if he sticks with it, I don't exactly think the Bengals are good, but I don't think they're actively sabotaging themselves either, you know? So I don't think Washington's a good enough team to get away with sabotaging themselves that much.
No, they are definitely not. So that definitely, you know, it helps explain why this one is just a 1.5 point favorite on the side of the football team as the home side in this one. So the definite chance of the Bengals coming in here and escaping with the victory. Let's go over to the Dolphins going up against the Broncos. I think from a side perspective, this is one of my favorite plays of the week. I know that betting against the Broncos in Denver can be a little bit tricky. And, you know, I imagine this is probably one of Tua's first or only cold weather games. I don't know what the weather looks like in Denver on Sunday exactly, but it'll be tough, at least compared to those SEC conditions or the Miami conditions, of course. But even still, I love the way that this Dolphins team is playing right now. And I cannot say the same about this Broncos team that also has a busted up quarterback situation.
Yeah, the Broncos are weird. Locke never was very good. And I know it's, you know, he's still a young quarterback. And it's unfair to expect a guy like him to just be consistent and good on the road, even if it's a bad defense, which certainly Las Vegas is. A game like last week is kind of within the reasonable range of expectations for him, but that's only just to kind of re-acknowledge that he's probably not very good, you know. And adding the ribs thing, and sorry, who is it? Are they going to Driscoll or are they back to what's his name?
it might be Rippon season.
Rippon again. Okay, well, that wouldn't be good. So yeah, Rippon against this Miami defense, I think, would be a total disaster. Like, really digging a deep pit kind of thing. So I'm kind of creeped out that 76% of the bets apparently are on the Dolphins right now. Sure. And the line has changed the spread has changed 4.5 points. So that's one of those things where, you know, how that feeling that we have when we sometimes look at a spread and it looks wrong to us and we think, like, you fools, we should be having like a collective kind of moment where we pause and reflect. And it's like, wait, we're all the dumb guys usually, and we all agree on this. But it's also a different thing, you know, 3.5 points versus, you know, +3.5 versus -1. Very different question. But yeah, I think even if Tua is bad, even if Salvin Ahmed or whoever's running the ball can't really get anything going in Denver, that Miami defense should be fine. And that Miami defense, especially if it's like, even if it is Locke, I don't think he can read those coverages. But if it's Rippon, he can't read those coverages and he can't throw it half as fast as Locke can. So if it, especially if it's Rippon out there, yeah, I just, you know, Bourbon Bowl 6-0 victory kind of thing.
Hey, 6-0 victory gets us the spread cover, though. So,
right. We'll that's the reason I said 6 instead of 3.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So this one sets up to be maybe not the most watchable game in the afternoon window. We're put up with a pretty tough afternoon slate of games here, Mario, actually. So let's get on to this next one.
Faster. Yeah.
Jets, Chargers. Chargers, 8.5-point favorites.
I'm not on this Kalen Ballage resurgence sort of theory. I think he's a big, fast guy who probably works hard and does the right things as like a professional football player. And I think when you give him a Justin Herbert offense in some of the settings over the last couple of weeks, creating some space for him to run. Yeah, being a big, fast guy who tries to do his job well, he can probably take advantage of a few of those. I've always thought, though, he can't survive a longer sample because he just doesn't have the instincts to play, and his instincts undermine him to the point that his physical tools become less effective and matter less. So I'm still fading Kalen Ballage as a player, but for the setup here, you know, the Jets, even if they play inspired on defense, they will eventually break on defense in this game. And if Kalen Ballage is running against a bunch of, you know, gassed quitters, then I think he will have an advantage over them. So it looks like it should be a good setup for him. I just think he's a sell high if he does have another good game here. Otherwise, Herbert gets back on track. He'll have a big game as long as they want him to anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, as long as this one isn't like a, you know, 30-point lead for the Chargers. Yeah. And if it is, you know, Herbert probably has a lot to do with that. So, you know, I'm with you there. Ballage, you know, he's taking advantage of his opportunity. You can't take that away from him over the last couple of weeks. But at the same time, not exactly expecting it to last. I will say it probably could last again this week going up against the Jets and, you know, gets a little bit of in-season revenge. That's
on Adam
nice.
Gase, yeah.
Yeah.
Was he there for one of the Gase years, or was he just there when Flores got there? I can't remember. But yeah, he's got the perfect setup, and
he would have he definitely would have been with Gase, right? Because
okay. So yeah, think of how much we hate Gase, and then imagine how much reason he has to hate him.
All of it. So yeah, this could be blood and guts central as far as that's concerned. Anything else to add on as far as these Chargers pass catchers go?
Well, you never want to fade Keenan, or you never want to like bet against Keenan Allen too much. But I do think this is a nice spot for Guyton and especially Mike Williams to get some really good matchups outside, because Brian Poole is a good slot corner. And yes, Keenan Allen, I would choose to win in that matchup. But will it be so much easier to throw to Williams that that doesn't matter? Like, will it just be Keenan's going to win on Poole over here, but nobody's covering Mike, so I'm just going to throw it to him. Like, that's kind of the thing that I'm imagining here is Mike Williams being wide open, and Guyton too. I mean, those outside corners for the Jets are terrible, and they can't run. Guyton can run, so if they're too slow, he will get away from them eventually.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a little bit of Guyton actually in some DFS last week, and I would definitely be fine to go back to the well with a matchup going up against the Jets. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's really much to mention on the Jets side of this, though.
No.
We'll continue on. We got Packers Colts Sunday afternoon. Indianapolis favored by 1.5 points. They are the home side in this one. I was talking to Liz about this game yesterday, and you know, for me, my knee jerk reaction is, you know, anytime that Indianapolis is going up against a competent to good team, my initial gut instinct is to go against Indianapolis because I'm just that far out on Phillip Rivers.
Yeah.
But there are some flaws that to this Packers team that theoretically Indianapolis could, you know, exploit at least enough to make this one an ugly game, the kind of game that they like to get into where they end up coming out on top when it comes to Indianapolis. So what are your thoughts on this matchup?
It's a little weird going to Indianapolis. I don't have in my head a good memory reel of Aaron Rodgers in domes doing well, but I think he should be fine. The Colts might be without two starters in the secondary, one slot corner, Kenny Moore, who he might play. I don't know, but he's got a rib thing. He's not just a slot corner. He's kind of like their one of their blitzers, too. They use him a lot, like kind of Mike Hilton has been used with the Steelers this year. So if he's out, that would be significant. It also looks like Kerry Willis, their safety. I think he's kind of like a strong safety type, but if he's out, that hurts them a little bit more in any case. So I try to wonder, you know, Davante Adams, he's, I think, the kind of receiver who's really good against all kinds of defenses. So sometimes you got to think a little bit about how a guy will do against this Colts coverage, because it's not quite man-to-man. They do a bunch of disguised coverages and just zones that fit together a certain way, and like the players execute it well, but it's not quite analogous to like getting open exactly. It's more like you just have to guess where they're not going and go there kind of thing. And Adams seems pretty good at that. He does well against the Bears, and the Bears, I think, kind of use some of those zone type principles too, more than other teams. So Adams is a guy who I don't think it really matters whether it's zone or man coverage. And if he's going, that's a big part of the puzzle right there, because we don't have reason to think Phillip Rivers can match Aaron Rodgers if Aaron Rodgers gets his number one receiver going at a customary rate. And then with Alan Lazard back, I don't think he exactly matches up great with Xavier Rhodes, especially, and to a lesser extent, even Rock Ya-Sin isn't a great matchup. But I think he's overall a pretty good player. And Matt LaFleur, he hasn't gotten much credit for this, and I have other like unrelated criticisms of Matt LaFleur, but I can grant him this much. Like, he's calling designed plays about as well as anyone in the league. Like, he's doing a lot of Sean McVay level kind of just uniquely good ideas, because you get these plays over and over in these Packer games where it's like they need a big play, and you know they can only really get the ball to Davante Adams or, you know, Aaron Jones. But Matt LaFleur keeps calling these plays that get that guy open. It's like these plays we've never seen before, where it all sets up. So like, you know, it's going to Adams, but you just can't really stop it for some reason, because he layers all the routes to get Adams free. And you see him do it with Aaron Jones. You see him do it with time to time, even like Tanyan and Jamal Williams too. So I think if LaFleur is as sharp play calling wise as he usually is, then he has some good ideas on how to deal with the Colts kind of novel schemes on defense. And if so, then they should, like, maybe Aaron Jones can't run the ball a ton. Like, the Colts, I would guess, are more easily attacked through the air. But Aaron Jones can contribute a lot toward that end. And as long as Rodgers is functional, I think that's enough, because Rivers basically can't be functional. Rivers can only win if the opposing quarterback is roughly as bad as he is, or so I'm reducing it to anyway. So I like the Packers enough. On the other side, I'm wondering, you know, a lot of people are understandably out on Jonathan Taylor, and I think it's, you know, certainly frustrating, and I had too high of expectations for him this year. I still think, not that this matters to fantasy investors, but I still think it's pretty clearly a case of just coaching malpractice. I think it's a case of Frank Reich and Tom Rathman, just on a personal level, really liked first Marlon Mack, but also Nyheim Hines, and to a lesser extent, Jordan Wilkins. And whereas you have a case like Clyde Edwards-Helaire in Kansas City, where Andy Reid decided, we are going to get this guy ready. We're going to make maybe he's not ready right now, but that's our job to fix that. Frank Reich is doing something more like the Matt Patricia, DeAndre Swift thing, where he's kind of saying, like, you got to show me that you've earned it kind of thing, instead of being kind of like grown up enough and realistic enough to look at it and say, like, wow, you're easily our most talented running back. We should probably make it a point of our jobs to make you the best you can be, because you can be better than these other guys if we put that kind of time into you. But they're not putting that kind of time into him. They're giving these practice reps to Nyheim Hines and Jordan Wilkins, and then in the games, their main objective is to make Phillip Rivers happen. They want to justify Phillip Rivers in that signing. So it's not as important to them to make Jonathan Taylor the best player he can be as much as it is
the case for Philip Rivers. And you're seeing it play out that way. Like the resources are being distributed according to that objective rather than the one of maximizing Taylor. And they're getting just what they basically asked for as a result. But even with everything being so dumb, and even with, Taylor basically, I think Taylor will be good for, I should say clearly, like, I think looking at some of his Wisconsin tape, his vision is good. What he needs to do is relearn like a new game, basically, because Wisconsin's offensive line was really dominant and he played with a fullback a lot, but he saw the field really well. And now I think he needs to just learn what it looks like to be without an offensive line advantage, basically. And he hasn't learned the rhythm yet.
Don't you feel like that was like part of the thing that made him like all the more appealing coming into this year? I mean, do you think that, you know, I tweeted this out maybe during last week's game against the Titans, but like, has there been one unit that has been more overrated during draft season that wasn't an actual fantasy player than Indianapolis's offensive line? Because I mean,
yeah,
everyone was
it's
so
gotten worse.
Yeah.
Yeah, it got worse. Costanzo was hurt earlier. I think Braden Smith or whatever might have gone into the year a bit hurt. But Philip Rivers being there has made it worse, too.
Well, because it shrinks everything. You know, yeah, the defense doesn't respect the downfield pass whatsoever.
Right. So when I was talking about how the Colts are trying to justify Philip Rivers rather than Jonathan Taylor and us seeing that play out in the results, I'm especially talking about the usage of Nyheim Hines. And Nyheim Hines last week, I know some people were saying, like, oh, he's just running better. He's got the hotter hand. Like, no, he does not. He's not. This is a guy who had a 3.8 yards per carry average after two full years in the NFL. He's never been good as a pass catcher. Nyheim Hines can specifically not run at all. That's the one thing we know he can't do. He can't see the field. He can't break tackles. He can't see the field. He can run and eat up space if it's there on like a draw play. And he gets generally lighter looks than Taylor because the defense correctly assumes that there's a pass play coming. So he gets different looks. He doesn't run better. And getting different looks is something that the offensive, the people calling the plays are supposed to manage and create, you know, dictate openings for Taylor by making the defense acknowledge these other threats. And they can't really do that because Philip Rivers is the quarterback. So Hines gets these better looks. And the other part of it is just kind of like small sample lack of attention span. It's like Nyheim Hines having two carries for 22 yards is not more meaningful than Taylor having, leading the team and rushing up to that point in the year. You know, it's like two carries is nothing. It doesn't matter. You have to remember who these players are over the course of their careers. But what was going on specifically in that Titans game was that the Colts were sticking with Nyheim Hines because the Titans would not put a defensive back on the field when Hines would go into the huddle. So Hines is a former receiver, and Rivers is basically a bad quarterback to the point that he needs a receiver lined up against a linebacker to get a guy open. So that's why they put him out there, because the Titans kept leaving Jayon Brown in man-to-man coverage against him. And to make Rivers justified, they needed to get a receiver against a linebacker because he would otherwise fail. So that was the choice as far as they saw it. And when it was framed that way, it was no trouble at all for them to put Taylor in away for good in that game, because they wanted Rivers to happen, and Hines against a linebacker was a way to do it. But the Packers are more than most teams willing to put five defensive backs on the field. So if they try to put Hines out there and instead of Jayon Brown, he's running against Will Redmond, we'll see how well that works.
Okay. All right. That was, you know, you hit all the key points there as far as this backfield usage is concerned for Indianapolis. One thing I did want to point out, and again, like I know that I've been fairly negative towards this Indianapolis offense throughout the course of the year, but I think there might be one bright spot, and it's Michael Pittman.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was kind of – it's hard for me to tell who he is exactly. And some of those plays they used him on last week, I don't think he's actually well-suited toward. But he's a good athlete, and he was good in college. So it's hard for me to get my hopes up on, like, week-to-week consistency with Rivers being the quarterback. Certainly the Titans' defense is about as weak as it gets. So yep. I think he's a much better prospect than, yeah, Pascal was. And T.Y. Hilton is, of course, kind of – getting phased out. So there's room for Pittman. I just, I don't know what a fair expectation is, especially as long as Rivers is the quarterback. Cause I think last week was like pretty close to the best case setup, you know, weak defense, kind of,
out of nowhere guy too.
Yeah. You know. Once there's some tape on him, defenses are going to do different things than they have to this point. He'll be fine. It's just, these things sometimes they kind of get, or these rookies kind of get into like struggle, you know, points where they need to make counter adjustments, and eventually they re-agree versus the league. But until then, it's kind of, there might be like ups and downs until then. And especially when you have a trash quarterback that can't throw downfield, I figure that can't help.
No, it definitely can't. So, you know, and that jives with the idea that maybe they're not using him the best or the most optimal way, because he does strike me more as like a downfield outside the numbers line type of guy. Yeah. And that's not really really any facet of this Indianapolis offense. I guess one thing I will say is that he's had seven or more targets in each of the last two games. So, you know, it wasn't just the Tennessee game. He did have seven targets against Baltimore. So I think we could at least think that there is a target floor there that we maybe didn't previously. I agree with you where he's not going to catch seven out of his eight targets for over 100 yards every single week. But it wouldn't shock me if, you know, he does see enough volume to maybe make it worth taking a look at him in DFS, or if you're really hurting in a deep league for streaming purposes.
Yeah, I don't know if you would see Alexander even if Alexander is back, but if Alexander is out, then Pittman's running against a bad corner pretty much all game.
Oof. All right, so that's another thing to keep in mind heading into Sunday. Let's go on over to the Cowboys going up against the Vikings. Mario, fun little quiz here. Who leads the league in team yards per play?
Dalvin Cook? Oh, no, it's Justin Jefferson.
As a team, the Minnesota Vikings lead the entire NFL in yards per play.
Oh, I misunderstood. Yeah, that's interesting. It's still basically because of Dalvin Cook, I assume, and Justin Jefferson. I mean,
that answer, that should have just counted, basically. And they're doing that despite having, or it's not really a despite thing, but it is also worth noting that they're running the second fewest plays per game as well for the Vikings. So they're low volume, high efficiency.
I guess it makes kind of sense for them since they have no depth, but yeah, that's always a bummer when you have to do the no volume offense. It's kind of just like a bad team thing to do. But in this setting, the narrow tree is kind of a convenient thing in a setup like this, because Dallas can't pose any resistance. And yeah, Dalvin Cook, I guess it's like the question of how much damage Thielen and Jefferson do kind of is dependent on, like, does Dalvin go over 200 yards in this? Because running the fewest plays, it's like they're not specifically trying to get Jefferson and Thielen going. It's more like when they have to. And they always start with Dalvin Cook. And if they need more, then the receivers will eventually get going. But will they need to do more against Dallas? I'm open to the possibility of a close game here. I'm not particularly attached to it, though, because as much as I think the Vikings defense is not particularly good, and I don't think their corners are good at all. Do we know, is it going to be Dalton who's at quarterback in this one?
Seems like it's trending that way.
Okay. I don't know. He looked really bad against the Cardinals, so I don't know if I care.
He's off the COVID list as of Wednesday.
Wow. I mean, that's good. I just don't know if it... The receivers should be open, I guess. I don't know why it would be a better situation than the Cardinals game, you know? Like, that was a game where the receivers all had the advantage, too. So, I don't know, man. I guess... There's no reason, or if you have to go with one of those Dallas receivers, I guess don't worry about it. But I'm not trying to get my hopes up for like a strong finish for the Dallas offense or anything like that, even against kind of a weaker Minnesota pass defense.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we see where bad quarterbacks can sink absolutely everything and not be able to take advantage. Like you're saying, the Vikings, they don't have a particularly strong defense, and it's definitely not deep at all, but they were still able to limit the Bears offense, and the Bears offense is one of the worst in the league. And I think that you could also argue that the Dakless Cowboys offense is also among the worst in the league. So the Vikings have their flaws. I just don't think that Dallas has enough firepower to make them pay for it at all.
Right. So I think it makes a lot of sense to still get some exposure to maybe Kirk Cousins, but at least Jefferson and Thielen in like your tournament DFS lineups, because if even like Cincinnati Andy Dalton steps onto that field, then Dallas should be able to make it competitive. But I don't think Zeke runs for much. As much as the Vikings defense is worse, Eric Kendricks is still Eric Kendricks, and he's in himself pretty much like a shutdown threat for whoever the running back is, and for running back routes or tight end routes, he's a shutdown threat there too. So, but if Dalton plays like a vaguely dignified quarterback, you know, the slot corner cannot cover CeeDee Lamb. The outside corners cannot cover Amari Cooper, and they can't even cover Michael Gallup. So those three guys are all open. It's up to Dalton to just not miss the barn every single time.
Hopefully he can be on target and hit the broadside of the barn. Let's go over to the night games. Let's get into Chiefs versus Raiders. The Raiders obviously had one of the more surprising season going into Kansas City and beating the Chiefs earlier on. I think there were like two touchdown dogs in that one. Getting a little bit more respect here, but still giving or getting 8 points at home against the Chiefs. Chiefs coming off the bye, of course. What do we got here?
Well, the Raiders defense apparently might be out with COVID concerns, so we'll see how that goes. I guess they were going to be bad either way, but more likely bad either way. I suppose that situation can't help anything. So, yeah, Sammy Watkins is back. I don't know if it really
would
matter.
Yeah, that whole defensive line, right? Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's like 8 of 11 or 9 of 11 players they have to send home until Sunday or something. I don't know. It's insane. But it's like Mahomes was probably going to light them up either way. Maybe it doesn't change a whole lot. Can't help anything for the Raiders. Sammy Watkins coming back. Basically, you're subtracting DeMarcus Robinson and replacing him with Sammy Watkins. Watkins might not be great, but he's like five times as good as DeMarcus Robinson. So I think, you know, Mahomes rolls here. The question is, can Carr strike back? And Carr has shown a new willingness to throw downfield, at least when Ruggs is on the field this year. And he really actually made his first showing this new, like, renovated version of Derek Carr actually debuted in that previous Chiefs game. So
right.
We know the personnel can be exploited if Carr plays that way and if those two sides call plays like they did. I just figure Steve Spagnuolo will have some kind of adjustment. He'll not necessarily, you know, that's not just to say he'll win this time. Like Carr and the Raiders might anticipate these adjustments or just do something different on their part, and maybe those adjustments on Spagnuolo's part will go to waste. But in the meantime, I got to give Carr credit. Like, he's definitely not playing coward ball anymore. So that might have been a big part of why he was limited in the past, like his own, you know, mind, his own unwillingness to just step outside. And he's doing it now. And I think they've made meaningful improvement as a result of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can't believe the 180 that Carr has basically taken this year, because, you know, talking about Derek Carr in any sort of like fantasy football context the last couple of years, it's like, oh, gross. Like, you ended up with Carr on your team. Like, you know, how badly did you screw up your draft? You know, what do you think?
Somebody auto-picked.
Yeah, see, that kind of crap. And yeah, this year, you know, they've got him surrounded with some pretty interesting pieces, of course, and it's clicking. I mean, again, he's above average as far as that average depth of target is concerned, and that's like crazy compared to, you know, him who usually brings up the rear. I mean, he's checking in at 8.9 on the ADOT right now.
And at least in that last Chiefs game, he wasn't just throwing it that far. He was making on-target passes, too. Mm-hmm. So, like, at this point, like, I was always a Derek Carr critic, including up until that game. But it's like, now he's not Derek Carr anymore to me. Like, he's like some other kind of quarterback. And maybe that quarterback will turn out to be disappointing in some other ways. But my primary complaints about him just don't exist anymore. And that it's very weird. I don't know what to say about him critically at this point.
Oh man. What do you, I mean, in a year with so much other craziness, now we got Derek Carr getting respect on his name, wild stuff. I do think that overall the idea that the Chiefs are just have so much of an firepower advantage over what the Raiders might be rolling out on defense, that anything that the Raiders do on offense just simply isn't going to matter. If you get into a name your score game against the Chiefs, you're going to lose that pretty much every single time. So I'm with you on the Chiefs this week, but here's hoping that the Raiders can keep this one interesting on Sunday night. And then let's round things out. We got Rams Bucks Monday night, the main event of the week, arguably. Rams checking in as 4-point underdogs going across the country to face off against the Bucks. The Bucks, you know, kind of got right once again last week, just what they needed. Every time that they've lost this year, I believe that they've come back with a pretty resounding answer the following week. The Rams are tough, though. The Rams have really kind of changed my opinion of them this week. I thought that we'd see more of the 2019 form, but they look more 2018 than 2019 this season. So this is a really tough matchup for the Bucs.
Yeah, it is. And I would kind of give the personnel advantage to the Tampa Bay defense against the Rams offense. But even against, I consider Todd Bowles like a pretty great defensive coordinator, but even against a great defensive coordinator with great defensive personnel, it's not going to play one-to-one. Like the equation isn't just going to be like personnel versus personnel. Like McVay variable will make the Tampa Bay corners worse than what they basically are. And if Goff can just keep from falling apart, like that's not a guarantee. I mean, as much as those corners, I feel like there are basically no corners who are completely safe from McVay if he really has enough time to plan and scheme on something. But Shaq, I keep mixing him up with this Calhoun guy on the Patriots a couple of years ago, but it's Shaq Barrett, not Calhoun. And of course, Jason Pierre-Paul quietly having a pretty big year opposite him. It's like those guys can really rush the passer. And like that was something that previously was a question about the Tampa Bay defense. Like, yeah, they got these great corners and run defense, but they don't have a pass rush. This year, Pierre-Paul and Barrett are both going off. The corners, you know, maybe McVay tangles them up, but Goff can get rattled and those guys, those edge guys can get to him. So it's a little dangerous for Goff, or it's a lot dangerous for Goff. It's just also kind of dangerous for the Buccaneers defense. And I don't know which way the ball breaks on that one. The interesting thing is, I don't know what to expect of the Rams running game, especially, but I'm kind of pessimistic about it. Maybe this is irrational on my part, but I can't get it out of my head. Like even if Vita Vea isn't out there, I'm like, but the Buccaneers run defense is so tough. And part of that is too, is like, I just am kind of skeptical of the Rams running game in general. Like I don't consider it any better than average. So if the running game can't go, and if Goff isn't getting these like free shots at open receivers, I can imagine Goff actually having a pretty rough game. So I understand the spread. The only thing is, when I think about the Tampa Bay offense against the Rams defense, I'm not convinced that they do any better than the Rams offense against the Tampa defense, even in kind of like the bleaker scenarios for the Rams offense, because Tom Brady he's putting up big numbers, of course, but he has so much help around him and he still has a decent number of ugly plays. And when I look at this matchup, you know, I mean, Mike Evans is probably better at the refined aspects of wide receiver play than DK Metcalf. Like, Mike Evans is probably a wiser receiver. So sure. I don't want to just assume Evans loses to Jalen Ramsey just because DK Metcalf more or less did. But it's a pretty big risk. I mean, Jalen Ramsey, he's insane and he's kind of like dislikable in certain ways, and you know, he's probably a hothead and whatever else, but it's pretty difficult to argue with results like last week. And if, you know, Evans might not be 100% either. So if Evans is in any case kind of neutralized or shut down, then Tom Brady is left with, of course, Antonio Brown, which is just an ongoing ridiculous story, of course. But I don't like Antonio Brown getting open against Darius Williams. I don't think he can. I think Darius Williams has the advantage there. Chris Godwin, I think, could have a really big game here. If so, if there's a funnel away from Evans and a little Brown can't really pick up the slack that might result from Evans, I think it all goes toward Godwin, and I think he's up for it. Like, Godwin is still insanely good. People are kind of bored with him or whatever, but it's outrageous how effective that guy is. And he could have a really big game here, I think.
Yes, I like that call and the way you drew it up where, you know, you got tough corners on the outside for the Rams. Maybe that funnels things a little bit more towards the slot. Could that also funnel things a bit towards Gronk, who looked a little bit more like himself last week?
Yeah, and I don't know what to make of Ronald Jones's huge game. I'm shocked that Bruce Arians let him go back out there, but it's a good thing he did because it's more like the Bruce Arians the more typical Bruce Arians scenario is Ronald Jones fumbles on that first drive or whatever. doesn't play again, and they lose because Leonard Fournette had like 70 yards on 16 carries instead of 190 or whatever Jones ended up with. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of like a little bit like USC Ronald Jones. And if he's USC Ronald Jones, then that's a pretty good NFL running back, and maybe even more than pretty good. So it's been kind of funny and fun, like amusing to watch Ronald Jones like shake off the shackles of Bruce Arians, even as Arians continually tries to undermine him, in every sense. But it looks like it finally happened. I don't know how they put that one back in the bottle, you know?
Yeah, I'm totally with you there. I mean, we've believed in Jones for some time. For me, my faith wavered after last season, but I mean, he, talent-wise,
wavers on like an hourly basis. It's insane. It really does. We're finally free now.
Yes, the Arians effect, it might finally be gone, and yeah, just the constant doghouse type of oversight going on there. Maybe that will go out the window, and they can just kind of let Ronald Jones be Ronald Jones, and that is effectively a very good running back. Do you think that with this particular matchup, he could be that X factor, given that, maybe the outside passing game isn't working so well for Tampa Bay? Maybe they try to go to the ground a little bit more.
It's not up or anything, but the slack might exist, and he doesn't need to pick up all of it for the Buccaneers to win necessarily, especially if Goff has a bad game on the other side. But if Goff doesn't have a bad game, then the Buccaneers probably need Jones to have a good game, because I just don't know how much Chris Godwin and Gronkowski and Brown can do if Evans is more or less shut down by Ramsey. It's just especially if you factor in stuff like what if Brady starts getting a little rattled? What if they hit him a couple times? What if his rhythm is off because Donald or somebody gets to him a couple times in the first couple drives, and he starts missing throws that he has been making in his more comfortable moments this year? Like, they, as much as the Goff scenario is there for collapse, like, Brady can do that sort of thing on his end too. So there is going to be pressure on Jones either way, I think. And I don't know if he's running like last week, I guess I'm optimistic for him. Like, he seems to be becoming a better version of himself all the time. So you don't want to just, you don't want to assume he'll always look the way he used to. But it is a big task, because the Rams have gone more to like a two gap kind of thing this year, as opposed to the one gap Wade Phillips defense. And in a game like this, if they think Ramsey can contain Evans, then they are going to put that much more towards stopping Jones, because I don't think Antonio Brown's going to beat up Darius Williams. I think Darius Williams has the advantage there.
Love that. Love the read on this game. That really adds some extra layers of intrigue for when you throw this on Monday night. I'm really, really looking forward to this matchup between the Rams and the Bucks. Of course, looking forward to this entire week as a whole, looking forward to this Thursday night game. So once again, great stuff, Mario. That's going to wrap it up for this edition of the RotoWire NFL podcast for Thursday, November 19th. Make sure you tune in for Friday's show. Andrew Laird, Scott Gentstad, breaking down the DFS side of things. Thanks for listening.